of Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment, and is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems. Given questions about the accuracy of polling in the wake of America's recent elections and the vitally important role that polling plays in shaping everything from international to national and local strategies, joining us today is one of the world's leading experts on polling, Dr. Daryl Bricker, the global CEO of Ipsos Public Affairs, one of the world's leading polling and analysis firms. He's a great author, and I commend the book he co-wrote, Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. His latest book is Next, Where We Live, What We Buy, and Who Will Lead Canada's Future. Daryl, it's always an honor and pleasure having you on.
Well, thanks, Vago. I wish I was with you in person, as we usually are this time of the year, but hopefully next year we'll be seeing each other again.
Absolutely. Halifax International Security Forum is always one of the highlights of the year. And it's unfortunate that because of COVID, we're not all going to be able to convene in that great town in Canada's Maritimes, but certainly look forward to the terrific job that Peter and the whole team there are going to do to try to put us at least together virtually. So we've got that to look forward to. I'm glad you're joining us, because this program is really focused on strategists and strategy. But at the end of the day, it's very hard to make strategy in any meaningful way if you lack good information. And so one of the things that Ipsos does, you guys do polling, you do market research, you do political analysis around the world. And at this time, given the outcome of the election, I think that there is relief in many places that Joe Biden did win. But there is a question again. Of course, on the other hand, if you were a Donald Trump supporter, you're somewhat less happy with the outcome. But at the end, that the polling as in 2016 did not seem to reflect the reality of the situation. The margins were far, far tighter. Folks were saying that, this or that competitor, or whether it was Joe Biden, was leading by 11 points or 9 points, and managed in some places to eke out victories that were in tens of thousands of votes, not massive percentage point differences. Similarly, Susan Collins never led a single poll in the months leading up to the election, and in fact ended up winning handily. At the end of the day, there was this sense that polling has gotten a black eye as a result of it. Sort of two elections, one sort of calculated and missed it in Donald Trump won. And then this one somehow was still not as good. And you have a lot of people who are responding that, hey, look, we need more local reporting. We need to do more social media coordination. From your standpoint, as somebody who does this professionally, why is it so important to get this right? And what do you think happened wrong this time? And are we drawing the right lessons or the wrong lessons from what happened?
I think that there's a fair amount of commentary that's come out about polling driven by what specifically happened on election night. And the story, as we are, approaching a week away from the actual election, is a bit different than it was on election night. So when you look at actually what the consensus of polls, and I can also talk about our own polling, showed, the consensus of polling showed that Joe Biden was going to win. He did win. The vote percentage that they applied to Joe Biden was that he was going to win over Donald Trump by around 7%. That was our last poll, but it was also the consensus of polling. Well, Joe Biden's probably going to win by somewhere between 4 and 5. That in probably 45 of the states that polling was done in, that actually the winner that was projected to win won. Now, where there was a systematic problem was, again, in underestimating the actual market appeal or electoral appeal of Donald Trump. But the amount that was underestimated in the national polls was maybe 2%. So I would say, for anybody who's a strategist, think of anything else that you do that gives you that level of understanding about what's going on in an environment, and I think you'll be hard-pressed to find something that would give you an answer on that specific day in such an unbelievably unconventional situation, in which we were going through a COVID election that ended up having a turnout far higher than anybody was anticipating, and actually getting the numbers and the performance that close, even if polling didn't do as well as it might be able to do with maybe a few changes or maybe some reconsideration of how things are done, I don't know that there's anything else that would substitute and do as good a job.
So what do you think, right? Because one of the things, and I agree with you, right? Because pollsters always maintain that there is a margin of error. You know what you know, you know what you don't know. Good polls tend to tell you what the parameters and everything are that surround it. From your perspective, what were the lessons from 16? What are the lessons from this year? Because you and I have spoken about this before, right? The way you guys do it, and I'm not trying to be part of your business development team here, but you guys aren't just doing the polling. You are connecting it with the news reporting, the social media, right? And all of those other things. So what were the 16 lessons and the 20 lessons as you see them, both good and bad?
Oh, yeah. But exactly as you say, Vago, I mean, I don't really see what we do and pollsters, I think ones that have better performance don't really see themselves as pollsters. I mean, they've got this one snapshot in time and that's it. I mean, we're looking at all sorts of environmental conditions. We are looking at social media. I mean, there's nothing going on in social media right now in terms of analysis that we're not doing. And taking advantage of all the insight that we can get from that. But I can tell you, you know, doing analysis of social media in this election did not give you what the outcome was going to be. And if anybody was able to do that, everybody in the polling business would be switching over to it. It's a pretty still an unrepresentative sample of what people are thinking at any particular point in time. It gives you some good qualitative content, but, you know, the quantitative aspects of it are somewhat suspect still. And we do look at things like economic situations. We look at, you know, we have a base rate model, for example, to look at things like the approval of politicians, how that compares to, other politicians who've been in similar sorts of circumstances. So we set up conditions to kind of look at how to interpret the polling. So it's not just specifically the poll itself that informs what we were suggesting was going to happen in the election. And by the way, Vago, we were telling our clients, but also, you know, the media that we were working with, that this was going to be a close election, that Joe Biden was probably going to win. Right. We weren't saying that ever at any point that there was going to be a Joe Biden blowout. In fact, we only gave that about a 20% probability, 50% probability that it was going to be a close Joe Biden win, 30% that Donald Trump could possibly eke out a very close win. We were never at any point saying that there was going to be a Joe Biden blowout. So where that came from, I'm not really sure. But in terms of comparison to 2016, it was, like Wayne Gretzky used to be in hockey. I'm Canadian, so I'll use hockey as an analogy. Everybody knew Gretzky was going to get the puck in the last minute of the game. Everybody knew that that's what the Edmonton Oilers were going to do. Everybody knew that that was the strategy. They all set up their teams to defend against it, and they still couldn't stop it. And that's really what happened in this election, which leads one to believe that maybe some of the problems that we thought we had back in 2016, which, by the way, the polling was also reasonably accurate, but got the winner wrong. And if you get the winner wrong, it doesn't matter how close you are in terms of margin of error or anything like that. Nobody cares. So, that's what happened in 2016. But at that time, the suspicion was that there was a sampling issue that systematically excluded people who would be more likely to vote for Donald Trump. And I will say that as a social scientist, these are the types of problems that social scientists like to find. Sampling error problems, because they're relatively easy to find, to deal with. It means that you have to find a way to include more of those people so you don't misrepresent what their likely performance is going to be or their likely behavior is going to be in an election process. So everybody who's a credible pollster that was prepared to invest the money into dealing with the situation focused on solving that problem. And lo and behold, we end up with exactly the similar type of situation where Trump was underestimated again this time. So the raises the question, was it a sampling issue?
And I think you're right on the mark, right? For each accurate poll, there are a number of inaccurate polls. So even when you aggregate them together, everybody gets sort of painted by the same brush, right? There's a tendency of remembering, oh my God, you know, somebody said 11, that he's up by 11% or 9%. Whereas if you do go back and you take a look at it, some of the polling, even in Pennsylvania, was, you know, that Biden is within the statistic, you know, that we think he's ahead, but he is ahead within what our margin of error ultimately is. What do you think was happening in the electorate? I know there are people who voted for Donald Trump who would never admit to being Donald Trump supporters in public. And that was even with their friends. He is a polarizing figure. There are families who talk about strife and rifts associated with this, either with the support, financial and otherwise. It can cause stresses on friends and family. How do you account for people who are not being honest? I know that this is something you guys pride yourselves on how to sort of compensate for this. But it appears that some people may have responded to some of these polls less than candidly and, you know, had. How do you account for that? How do you compensate for that?
Well, again, this was one of those things that people sort of assumed from 2016 and allegedly had adjusted in this election, and it really didn't help very much. And the reason normally when it comes to lying in polls, the assumption is that it's randomly distributed. It may not be randomly distributed. In this instance, you know, as you say, there might be some idea of a shy Trump voter. But again, that's the kind of conclusion that a lot of people jump to really quickly. And by the way, pollsters tend to like it because it assumes that they didn't do anything wrong. That maybe the respondents weren't telling them the truth. And what can we do if people don't tell us the truth? I actually think that there's a greater range of potential errors that we have to look at that have everything to do with things, for example, like estimating actually who's going to participate in the election campaign on voting day. So when you've got an excessive amount of early voting, when you've got a COVID type of an environment, which is an automatic deterrent for people showing up on election day, and you end up in a situation where you actually get an over participation beyond what people were estimating of voters, and that over participation doesn't specifically benefit the candidate that you were assuming it was going to benefit, so Joe Biden.
Right.
What happened there? Is that people lying to you? Is that an estimation error? What went on in this? And the easy assumption, as I said, to make in all of these things, and I've certainly been reading all sorts of articles about this where we jump to the traditional conclusions, which are, we missed interviewing certain groups of voters or people lied to us. I think that those are the questions we like to ask and answer, but the more difficult questions to answer are all about estimation, because ultimately polls and predictions and elections are a form of modeling. So we have to ask some quite serious questions about things like maybe doing a good job of getting a good sample, maybe doing a good job of figuring out what people are going to do on election day in terms of their partisanship, but not doing a good job of necessarily figuring out if there's going to be something like differential turnout. Maybe the Trump voters are more motivated. And what we did see, at least in the branding research that we did around both candidates, was that Trump was a motivating factor for both sides.
Right.
So, and Joe Biden, it was the way I would describe him, he was almost like a passenger in a car. Right? I mean, he wasn't really driving anything. So it was a very complicated kind of an election. There were all sorts of things that one could probably point to as things that could have been issues with the polling. I take issue with the point that the polling was massively off, because I don't think that that's true. But it was off in enough places that we have to ask questions, and it was systematically off in a specific way, which was again underestimating Donald Trump's voting at a time when everybody knew that that was the problem that they were supposed to be dealing with. So what I'm saying in all of this is, let's not jump to easy conclusions. The answers are probably more difficult, and there's a lot of theories right now chasing too many data points or too few data points, and we need more analysis to really figure out what we're dealing with. But I will say to everybody on this, listening to this podcast right now, who uses polls or is interested in polls, people who work in this business, including me, are as interested in getting to the bottom of it as anybody. But I do know that the easy answers didn't pay off, and it's going to be the harder answers that are going to benefit everybody. So we're going to take what we learn from the U.S. election, just as we have from other elections that we bring to the U.S. to help improve our polling. We're going to be taking what we learned in the U.S., and we're going to be taking that to all the other countries where we do polling.
is what or may have happened in America an American issue, or are you finding similar problems or challenges or trends worldwide when you do your work?
Well, it's could be specifically related to certain types of populist candidates. So you can look at or populist type issues like Brexit, for example. So we do see that there is an element to the profile of the populist leader that has a certain effect on the public and their participation in politics that's somewhat different than what you would see in more of a traditional type of an election campaign where the politics isn't as divided and the personalities aren't as big. And so the question is, how do you include that factor in your estimates? And that's something that we're going to be taking a look at. So the real question here is, what we're seeing here, is it specific to Donald Trump in the United States, as you've said, and you've asked the real question, actually, specific to Donald Trump in the United States? And by that, not just being the United States, but also Donald Trump in the United States. So when we don't have Donald Trump possibly in the next election campaign, is all of this going to go away? The answers to those questions are we really don't know. And it's something absolutely worth investigating.
What is the social... So, right, what does the PhD social scientist in you tell you about? Because I know that you've always been intrigued by the question, right? You're a little bit like the namesake of this podcast, which is Andy Marshall. It's all about getting the question right. Did you get the question right? So how do you refine this to get the question right next time around, Darryl?
Well, I actually do think that we have the questions right. What we don't have quite the handle on that we need, particularly in cases like Maine, for example, because there were some specific areas, states that proved to be really, really, really problematic, like Florida, like Maine, where it's a different conversation than polling in general. But I actually think that we do a reasonably good job on the questions. I think we do a reasonably good job on the sampling. I think we also do a reasonably good job on the estimation. But I think that when we get through all of this, that you're going to find that there's little bits in each of these things that add up to 3%. And That's all we're talking about dealing with here in terms of the national polls. In the state polls, there are some specific circumstances, even in the states and most of the states, as I said before, by the end of this, it's going to be 45 or 46, in which the polling actually did do a pretty good job of predicting who the winner was going to be. They didn't pick the magnitude of the win correctly. They tended to have Biden doing better than he ended up doing in the state. But, you know, win or loss, did you get on the right side of the column? And we polling tended to get that right. But so there was something that was going on in all of this that's probably related as much to the estimation and the analytics as it is to, did we ask the right question? Probably there's refinements there. Did we ask the right people? Probably there's refinements there. But I think on the estimation part of it, you know, differential turnout, like who's more motivated to show up, is going to end up being a bigger part of the story.
So after 16, we were talking in Halifax, and I didn't know anybody, even in the United States, who had looked precinct by precinct the way that you had. And you were stunned at how tiny each of the individual margins for Donald Trump were in where he won. And said, like, oh my God, he won exactly in every single place he had to win in order to win, right? Which is pretty impressive. You mentioned, so you're somebody who does have a real granular eye for this. So it's a two-part question. The first is somewhat easier. Why were Maine and Florida so hard to poll? And the second part of that question is, as somebody who has an eye for the granular, do you need precinct by precinct adjustments to your polls?
Well, we don't, But because the general polls, and as long as you have reasonable geographic or regional distribution, you're reasonably good. And by the way, politics is, you know, all politics is local, and it is geographic. And so you do have to have good, you know, good distribution. I didn't poll in Maine, so I don't have a good answer on that. Okay. We did poll in Florida, so I do have some insight on that. And I would say that the storyline that you're hearing out of Florida is reasonably accurate, which is that assuming that because you've got a reasonable Hispanic sample, that you've got the right Hispanic sample is probably the wrong assumption. That Cubans are not Mexicans, and that the variable is not really Hispanic. Particularly when you get into places like Miami-Dade and you're dealing with a larger Cuban population, where Donald Trump outperformed what estimates in terms of particularly that area, how he was going to perform. That was, I think, something that we may have known, the industry may have known. I don't know how many people adjusted for it. I don't think however the adjustments were made, they were made enough.
So, and of course, I think that's
Florida. It's having a better understanding of when we're looking at Hispanic voters, what we mean by Hispanic voters, and it's not just a language question. So, you know, a lesson we probably should have learned in 2016, something that should have been adjusted in our polling in this election. We thought we dealt with it, but clearly we didn't deal with it well enough.
What is the future, right? I mean, of how you go about doing this, right? So on the one hand, you know, you're trying to, right? Because I mean, the whole game is evolving since the birth of modern polling was in the 20s and the 30s, right? Mm-hmm. And they continue to be refined, they continue to be improved. But you know, some people have made, you know, you're reaching people on cell phones, you're not reaching them on their home numbers. People avoid, they have caller IDs and things like that, and automatic things that dump your calls. So you actually end up accidentally catching people who happen to answer their phones and things like that. How does all of this need to be? Because I know you guys are working on this in terms of the technological refinement. But how does that technological adaptation happen? You know, how are you guys, to use another hockey analogy, you know, skate to where the puck is going to be as opposed to where the puck's been?
We've been skating that way for quite a while now. And our view is that there's no such thing as one poll that does it all or one methodology that does it all. If you take a look at, there was a whole variety of different methodologies that were used in the U.S. election. Some of them performed in some places better than others performed, but you know, the performance of, say, for example, online polling, which is basically what we do, in comparison to the old gold standard, you know, cell phone / landline live caller type polling, there wasn't a huge degree of difference between how well they did. So I would say that the issue here is not necessarily how you contact people. You can find enough people who are willing to participate in polls that you can get a reasonably good estimate. As I said, I mean, if you're talking about the disaster of public opinion polls in the 2020 election, we're talking about maybe a 3-point miss in the national polls in the gap. I mean, right. That's hardly a disaster. I'm not being cavalier about it. I mean, obviously, if we'd predicted a different outcome, like in 2016, it would be a much more difficult question. But in fact, in some ways, maybe the polling was even more accurate in 2016, to be honest. And at least that's how some of the post analysis looks like. But the way that we're skating to the puck is by recognizing that there's multiple inputs that you need in order to be able to evaluate what's going on in terms of public opinion and what's happening in an election. And it's not just about doing a poll and reporting a result. It's about, and I hate this word, but I can't think of a better one, a narrative about what's actually going to happen. And that there are different possibilities based on different likelihoods of people participating in the election campaign. And we should be open to that. So whatever we're providing on election day about what's going to happen is an estimation based on certain things occurring. And we need to be really honest about how confident we are about certain things happening. So when we put out our estimate for the election, we said, look, probably around a 50% probability that Joe Biden's going to win a close election here, 30% possibility that Donald Trump might win, and maybe a 20% possibility if there's going to be a blowout, that'll be a blowout that benefits Joe Biden. But that the most likely outcome is it's going to be a close election. That was not what I heard reported by a lot of people on election night who were supposedly using polls to drive their commentary. They certainly weren't reporting what we were saying. And the reason that we were feeling the way that we were was because we were looking at things like, for example, Donald Trump's approval levels. And we know because of our base case model that we have comprised by looking at over 1,000 elections worldwide, that incumbent leaders, candidates, party leaders or candidates who have an approval level over 40% get reelected around 55% of the time. So Donald Trump's approval level was in the low 40s.
Right.
So we were seeing him doing, particularly in the battleground states, better in terms of performance, where his approval level was even higher than the low 40s. It was pushing up into the mid 40s, but his vote performance wasn't as strong. So we were sitting there thinking, this doesn't add up. So that's why one of the reasons we were really cautious in terms of what we were projecting. So if anybody had phoned me up, you know, the election day, and people were calling me up, you know, before election day and saying, what's going to happen? What I would say is, God, it's close. It looks like Biden's going to win it, but there's these things out there that I'm worried about. One of them is Trump's approval level looks a bit better than one would expect for somebody who's going to lose. And particularly in places that are going to be important to the outcome of this election, his vote doesn't seem to be looking in our polls as good as his approval level does. Those things usually aren't mismatched. They usually match up. So I'm concerned about that. Plus all the other issues that we talked about before. It looks like a lot of people are going to turn out. It looks like extra turnout is going to benefit Biden, but you know, I really don't know because he's not that motivating a character in all of this. Most of the motivation is, you know, around Donald Trump. Are we right, getting this right? So we had, you know, we were pretty tentative about all of this. The media commentary that I was listening to, particularly on the television networks, was not cautious. That's something I can't fix. I can tell them what the situation is, but if they want to talk about big blowouts, and if they were shocked on election night, I was disappointed with what I saw on election night, but you know, talking to our team in Washington, they just kept saying the same thing to me over and over again. Wait.
Right.
Wait.
There you go. There you
votes
go.
Being to count.
There you go. Being a responsible Canadian again, Darryl. One thing which I do am intrigued by was this again. I mean, I think that he had much stronger support, and then you can't help but, you know, then obviously people expected, right? I mean, 71 million people or even more voted for him at the end of the day, despite everything that's happened over the past 4 years, or maybe in spite of what's happened over the past 4 years. And what I think was also interesting, and I don't know how you compensate for it, is Democrats usually are the ones who do really well door to door, for example, but they suspended doing that, right? Whereas Republicans saw how big of a push, the surge in mail-in ballots, and assumed that a lot of those would have been for Biden, which proved to be the case. And then they went door to door and managed to find voters that you normally find by going door to door that then do not get reflected in polling too, right? I mean, so I see your point about the incredible difficulty of trying to do this when there were apparently a lot of first time or voters who hadn't voted in a long time, right? So, you know, effectively first time voters or first time in a long time voters who ended up going for Trump in some of these cases. So it's a real
challenge. I don't know that we missed them, but what we might have missed was their motivation.
Right.
So there were clues. So we knew that, as I said before, his approval level was higher than we thought. We knew that all of the energy in the campaign was either directed by him or at him. Joe, as I said before, Joe Biden was like riding, a passenger in the car. He wasn't really defining what was going on in the election. And so that was all there. But how to calibrate it and build it into the model of what you thought was going to happen on election day, that was tough.
So,
but still, even as tough as it was, and I don't want to sound dismissive or cavalier or defensive or anything like that. If I would have offered you something that said, I'm going to be able to tell you within 3 points who's going to win the election tonight, and I'm going to be able to correctly predict, say, 45 of the states, would you have taken it?
Yeah.
Yeah, anybody would. So when anybody sort of goes off polling, yes, there are things that you can correct, but there's nothing better. It's like when I hear about the networks are going to spend more money on shoe leather and getting reporters out there and, you know, getting into the world and trying to understand, how people think. Well, great. I think that's great. That's doing their job exactly as you said. But what makes you think that they're not biased?
Right.
What makes you think that they don't see things in a certain way? What makes you think that they have a really good sense of what's going on? I mean, given that they're all educated in journalism schools and Ivy League colleges and all the rest of it, and most of the action in the election campaign actually took place in the suburbs, a place they don't live.
Right. Well, I think a fair measure of them might still live in suburbs, right? But I do take your point, right? I mean, it's a different demographic that's actually talking more often.
Or rural small town.
Correct. Well, right. The New York Times is talking to New York Times people. New York Times is not necessarily talking to somebody who is, deep in Pennsylvania in a red precinct, doing, a non-college educated job. I'm not being pejorative at all. It's not clear you're getting to that person, in terms of how your programming goes. Let me ask one follow-up to this. So is there a fervency quotient you need to build in to your polls, right? That Trump voters are exhibiting a tendency to walk barefoot in the snow for a mile to vote for their candidate and have like a fervency score, of 0 to 10 of 9. Whereas, a Hillary Clinton voter is closer to a 5, or 6.
Yeah, we actually do that. So we have a scale that relates to people's ability to turn, willingness to turn out. And our view is that it's focused too much on probably, and I would say this is for all the pollsters, focused too much on the act of voting rather than on the act of voting for somebody specifically, which is something that we're investigating. So it focuses on the habit of voting. So how likely are you to vote? And we imply you're voting for somebody based on how you answered the vote question, rather than saying something about how likely are you to vote for Donald Trump specifically, and really looking at the intensity of your willingness to show up to support that specific candidate or Joe Biden. So it's because we focus so much on the behavior, the activity of voting, leaving aside who the vote is for, as opposed to the specific motivating aspects of the individual candidates, that we may not have calibrated it as well as we could, which is a different problem from making sure that you interview the right proportion of Cuban voters in Florida. So there's a whole series of these things. So when I read the articles, and I've read them, you sent me some, I've read a lot on that's been coming out, a lot of data points here, a lot of very interesting things, a lot of hypotheses about what happened, but not a lot of analysis. And there's going to be no easy answers, but everybody's going to be going back to the woodshed, as we do after every election, to really take a close look at everything that relates to our methodologies.
Let me ask you one last question, and I apologize for not in advance if I'm asking something that you're already doing. You're obviously always, whether online or when you were calling people up, try to peel off their both conscious and unconscious bias and sort of understand what it is, where they really are, right? And a lot of sophisticated techniques to do that, and turning it blind, and you know that the person being interviewed doesn't know who it's for. Do the vast quantities of data that are collected through e-commerce and social media, you know, because that's their gold and some of it they don't part with. It's your gold to try to collect and extrapolate some of this. Is the aggregation of that data potentially tell you far more than any poll that you can construct? Can you get a more authentic view of folks by looking at QAnon hits in regions, or you know, how many times people went to Donald Trump website? Like, are there, I'm trying to understand how all of this vast oceans of data out there, some of which, right, if you're a Google or an Amazon or anybody else or a Facebook, you may not want to part with, is that where the truest, and how do you tap that, right? The truest reflection of things lie.
If you can relate it specifically to politics, maybe. But the truth is that we have no shortage of data. And that's the point that you're making. What we have a real shortage of is insight and meaning. I mean, it's the issue that we deal with in a lot of data science these days is data reduction. How do you reduce it to something that somebody can actually understand and actually points to the types of conclusions that you're talking about? And the truth is, at this point, if there was somebody who did that, they didn't do it in this election in real time, like the people who were doing polling. The one case, and there's been a couple of other cases, and I know one specifically where somebody's developed you know, a technology that they used through Twitter and said they had an incredible, you know, record of reporting on elections, you know, particularly contrary to what the pollsters were saying. And they had Joe Biden winning 366 electoral college votes. Well, okay, thank you.
Right.
didn't do very well. Right. So, you know, some of these things can maybe work one time. The thing about polling is that even in spite of the fact that it has its moments where, you know, questionable results are put out, or maybe some people are giving it more accuracy maybe than sometimes it deserves in terms of its performance. If you look back over the space of the last 40 years, you will always find issues in which polling has missed the boat. The thing about pollsters, responsible pollsters, is they always learn from them and they hopefully get better the next time around. It doesn't eliminate those things from happening, but it usually gets rid of the ones, the reasons that they happen before we adjust. And if you look at the record of polling worldwide over the space of the last 20 years, it's actually pretty darn good. In fact, better than any other alternative method for being able to predict a specific election outcome on one day, in one of the world's biggest democracies in the United States. It did reasonably well, not perfectly, but it, you know, basically got a lot of the answers right. There's nothing that's come out of that big data world that performs at that level yet. Will there be at some point? Yes. Will the people who are in the polling industry be very likely to get there and use that information, maybe even faster than the people who currently hold the data? Quite possibly.
Does AI change any of this at the end of the day, or is there so much human factor to this that even AI may have some limitations in how it eats through this information? Or is it the solution?
It hasn't proven to be able to do it yet. But again, this is something that people who are particularly the bigger pollsters who are capitalized to be able to, you know, do research on research and invest in using technologies like that to improve their understanding of what's going on. Yeah, we'll look at everything. I mean, at some point, you know, the CEO of our company says that at some point we're going to have, you know, through social media, other forms of connections, we're going to be able to figure out a way that's even more accurate than the way that we do it now to do estimations of what's going to happen in something like an election campaign. So, you know, our goal is to find a way to incorporate all of these things in a really systematic way. And so, and all of them help a little bit.
Right.
And remember, all we're trying to do is fix 3%.
but fair, right? I mean, funny, but fair, right?
Yeah, that's what we're looking for. So as you know, as I said, probably a couple of times, not ready to throw out the baby, the bathwater and the tub and everything right now in polling. There's some things that have to change. Are there lessons to learn from this election? Absolutely. Do we know in the places where things went wrong, what went wrong? A little bit. We have a little insight on what's happened, but there's a lot more research to come. And guaranteed that the people who are in this business, and I know I can speak for Ipsos, we're going to be learning, we're going to be investigating, and the next time out, we'll be trying to get it even closer.
Do you think you can get it closer than 3% at some point, or do you think that that's the theoretical limit of accuracy?
Well, the theoretical limit of accuracy and, you know, a poll of 1,000 people, well, actually, the one I know the best is, you know, 1,500, which would be plus or minus 2.5%, means that there's a 5% error rate that's just a product of the methodology that you're using. Right. That you could do everything perfectly and still be off by 5, 2.5 on either side. So 3 is not bad.
Darryl, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much. Looking already forward to having you back on after the global security trend data is out. I know you guys announced that on the eve of Halifax. So the week after that great event, would love to have you on so you can talk to our audience about global national security perceptions. Thanks so very much again.
Thank you, Vago. My sincere pleasure.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.